Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Michael Reed Show podcast. Tune in weekdays from 9 on LMFM. To contact us, email now, michael@lmfm.ie.
Hello, good morning and welcome to the Michael Reed Show. This is Ken Murray sitting in for Michael Reed. Michael will be back with you in the hot seat tomorrow morning. Okay, busy program between now and 11 a.m. and if you do want to get in touch, you can text or WhatsApp us on 086-1800-658. You can give us a call on 041-983-2000. Now, unpublished research by the Housing Commission says Ireland may need up to 62,000 homes built per year until 2050 to meet current demand. That's almost double the annual target in the government's master plan for this decade. The research, which was shared with the Minister for Housing, Dara O'Brien, in November, indicates that Ireland requires between 42,000 and 62,000 homes every year. This is quite a figure, bearing in mind that only 29,000 houses were completed last year. So the government has a problem on its hands. And added to this is the statement this morning that the industry that relies heavily on immigrants, such as those who are in areas like software development or areas like the medical sector or indeed in engineering and so on, are having difficulty attracting people into the country simply because there's no place for them to stay. Well, look, to get some sort of an insight as to where we're at on the housing and homelessness situation, I'm joined on the line right now by Peter McVerry of the Peter McVerry Trust. Peter, thanks very much for joining us on the programme. First of all, in terms of homelessness, how bad is the current situation?
The current situation is at record levels. It's never, ever been so bad. We have a registered 11,600 people homeless, but that's probably only half or less of the number. It doesn't include women and children in domestic refuges who can't go home. It doesn't include 5,000 refugees who have been given permission to stay in Ireland but can't find any accommodation. Doesn't include people who are sofa surfing or sleeping in tents or sleeping rough. So the probable number is twice or maybe even three times that. But to put that in perspective, because it's only a number, and numbers sort of numb us, last year, every single day, five single people and two families became homeless. That's the reality of it in an understandable sort of way. And that situation is just intolerable.
Well, no doubt the causes of homelessness are long and varied, but what seems to be the common cause? Is it a case of, you know, somebody falling out with somebody in a family, or somebody losing their job and unable to meet the mortgage, or is there a particular common thread?
Yes, the main reason why people are becoming newly homeless these days is eviction from the private rented sector. Either because they can't afford to pay the rents anymore, or more likely the landlord comes along and says, I'm selling the premises, you're going to have to move out. That's the main cause of homelessness. Secondary causes are breakdown in relationship, but the main cause is eviction from the private rented sector. So people who are homeless don't want to be housed in the private rented sector because their fear is that at some stage in the future, they may become homeless once again. So they're looking for housing with security, which means social council housing, basically.
This report that was published this morning by the Housing Commission focuses on the fact that there's been population growth, and this suggests that the massive influx of immigrants into this country has put massive pressure on the whole area of housing provision. Would you see it that way?
Partly, but I wouldn't want to put the immigrants into the country in the main place. The main reason for the increase is demographic. It's smaller numbers of people who are in relationships that are breaking down. So more people need homes. It's due to the fact that the demographic, more people are becoming 18 or over 18 or into their 20s, and they're looking to move out of the family home. So it's the demographics that have pushed this number to 60,000. Not so much immigrants there, only a tiny minority of the people who are actually going to need housing.
Okay, but I have to put the question to you, and I don't know if you find this, but if the state is housing immigrants, that means then that there's less housing to go around, we'll say, for people born in this country who then end up homeless. Isn't that the case?
It's certainly the case that there is pressure on housing. The pressure on housing was there long before the huge influx of immigrants that we've seen with Ukraine and other nationalities in recent year or so. That pressure on housing was already there. Many of the immigrants that are coming into the country are not being housed in places that homeless people would be housed in. They're in direct provision. 5,000 of them, as I say, are still in direct provision because they can't find a home to move into. They are being housed, the Ukrainians are being housed in empty commercial buildings. They're still up to recently being housed in tents. So it's not quite a simple quid pro quo that the immigrants are taking up housing that Irish-born people should be using. But undoubtedly, there is huge pressure in the housing system, regardless of the immigrants, and the immigrants certainly do make that pressure that little bit greater.
Now, you mentioned earlier on that a large number of landlords are leaving the sector, and one of the reasons landlords are leaving the sector is because the taxes they have to pay make it unattractive for them to, if you like, hold on to what is in many cases a second house. Many people buy a house with the intention of renting it out so that by the time the mortgage is paid off, they will have some sort of an income that will be a nice little boost to their pension. Have you found from your discussions with people in government that this is an area that badly needs to be overhauled?
Well, certainly I've called for a reduction in rental, in taxation of rental income for landlords. I have called for that, but I don't think that's the primary reason why they're leaving the sector. I think the primary reason they're leaving the sector is that house prices now are reaching their peak and landlords are cashing in on their asset. They want to sell the house while the prices are high and not wait until price of housing drops. I think that's the primary reason. Remember, 10 years ago, rents were only half of what they are now. And landlords weren't complaining. Now rents are at an absolutely outrageous level. So I don't see that landlords are complaining about the tax that they're paying. Of course, some landlords are in financial difficulties. I absolutely accept that. Some landlords are finding it very difficult to pay the taxes. And my proposal would be that if landlords reduce the rent for their tenants by 30%, and the government reduced the tax on rental income for landlords by 50%, that's a win-win situation for everybody.
Well, obviously, you've made that point to government. Do you think government is listening?
I think they think that would be very expensive. I think that was the initial response I got from government, that this could be extremely expensive. But I think we've got to think outside the box. it's no use tinkering around with the system. Tinkering around with the system is not going to solve this housing crisis. We've got to think outside the box, and we've got to bring imaginative and creative solutions to the problem. One of the solutions is the Kenny Report, and I keep coming back to this.
This was published back in the 1970s, if I recall.
50 years ago. Kenny Report recommended, without going into details, recommended controlling the price of building land. The cost of the land on which a house is built is often one-third of the cost of the final cost of the house. If you introduce the cost of the Kenny Report, a 450,000 house at the moment would be reduced to 300,000. It would make houses far more affordable. But every time you mention this, you get a blank stare back. It's not even discussed. It's not even... I fail to understand why governments cannot at least discuss the Kenny Report and look at ways of implementing it.
Isn't one of the problems that some TDs are landowners themselves, and for obvious reasons that if their land was to be put on the market for housing, they want the maximum price, and that's where part of the problem lies?
It may be. I don't know whether how many TDs own land that would be suitable for housing, but I think there should be public pressure on the government to at least look at the Kenny Report and see if it can and how it can be implemented. But one of the objections by government is that it's contrary to the right to private property in the Constitution to control the price of building land. But the judge, Judge Kenny, who was chairing the Kenny Report, he was a High Court judge. He didn't think it was contrary to the Constitution. And even if it was found to be contrary to the Constitution, let's go and change the Constitution and bring it in. We need to bring in that Kenny Report. We'd make housing far more affordable to far more people.
Okay, I mean, we could go on about the issue then of negative equity, so if that scenario was to kick in, but we're going to have to leave it there because we've other people to talk to, but no doubt this is an issue that's going to rumble on and on and on in the months and years to come. Okay, more to come on the programme. We'll take a break.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
This is Ken Murray sitting in for Michael Reid. Michael will be back with you tomorrow. And as I say, if you want to get in touch, you can call us on 041 983 2000, or you can text or WhatsApp us on 086 1800 658. Okay, we're staying with that story that I just discussed there with Peter McVerry, that the Housing Commission is saying that Ireland may need up to 62,000 homes built per year until 2050 to meet current demand. This is obviously a very adventurous proposal, bearing in mind that last year, I think 29,000 houses were built, and it's still not enough. One man who would certainly have a view on that is Owen O'Brien, who is the Sinn Féin TD for Dublin Midwest and his party spokesperson on housing. I know, Owen, you will just say, well, you know, the government is failing miserably in relation to house provision. But let me put the question to you. If you were the Minister for Housing tomorrow and Mary Lou MacDonald was the Taoiseach and you had, as they say, the levers of power in your hands, what would you do to increase housing supply?
Well, the first thing, of course, is you need an objective assessment of the number of homes that are actually needed. And one of the fundamental flaws of the government housing plan was the targets that are underpinning it. And that's not just the macro target of 33,000 new homes a year, but within that, the social and affordable targets were always too low. In fact, they were politically massaged, in my view, and we've said that for many years. Thankfully, the Housing Commission are doing independent research, and while the 62,000 is the upper figure, they're saying somewhere between 40 and 60. They're providing a range over a period of time. To answer your question specifically, we've argued that the state, first of all, needs a target of 20,000 public homes, social, affordable rental and affordable purchase. And we've published detailed proposals as to how we believe those homes could be delivered and delivered faster than the current government rate. For example, we have tens of thousands of vacant homes across the state. And if local authorities were given money in advance alongside significant targets, we believe they could acquire, refurbish and either rent out or sell many of those vacants. Likewise, we have a lot of companies, both public and private, who are developing new building technologies that can provide off-site manufacture of high-quality homes in shorter periods of time. The problem is there isn't a special framework agreement for tendering and procuring those, and we've made that proposal as well. But also, local authorities need to be given more funding and higher targets to deliver those social affordable new builds. And in order for them to do that more quickly, a lot of the red tape that is imposed on our local authorities needs to be cut back. In fact, Owen Burke-Kennedy, the business editor of the Irish Times, has a very good analysis piece highlighting the insane levels of bureaucracy that are imposed on our local authorities. So it's about vacants, it's about new building technologies, it's about cutting the red tape, and ultimately it's about greater capital funding and more ambitious targets. That's only the public housing side, because obviously we have to also work with the private sector for them to deliver private homes to rent and buy at more moderated prices as well. But the one thing the state can absolutely control is public housing output, social and affordable rental and affordable purchase. And that's what we think the government is failing most to do currently.
Isn't one of the big problems, Owen, that when the economic crash happened in 2008, that in the subsequent 3 or 4 years, something like, I think it was about 120,000 tradespeople left the country, the electricians, the carpenters, the blocklayers, the roofers, the tilers, the plasterers, they all went to Canada and Australia. There's currently a scarcity of tradespeople, and that this is slowing up completions. Is it time for the government to do something to either attract these tradespeople back or make going into a profession such as being an electrician or a carpenter more incentivised?
Well, first of all, it's not the case that we couldn't increase public housing output because of a lack of labour supply. There are labour supply challenges, absolutely. There's a story again in one of the newspapers this morning about a fall off last year in the number of apprenticeship registrations. But if you talk to the Irish Home Builders Association, for example, they represent kind of medium-sized builder developers. They'll actually tell you there is extra capacity for house building in the sector at the moment. It's also important to stress that we have too many builders building the wrong kinds of things. In Dublin, for example, a lot of apart hotels and co-living in other parts of the country, data centres. And the reason why they're building those things is because the government is giving the wrong kinds of tax incentives, leading to the wrong kinds of development. So, yes, we need to strengthen and improve our apprenticeships. Yes, we need to ensure that people working, particularly in the wet trades, aren't forced into low-paid, kind of bogus subcontracting and are instead in proper PAYE employment. Likewise, with the new building technologies, a lot of those technologies don't require outdoor work on sites. It's factory-based employment. Some of it is very highly skilled as well. So, yes, I think government needs to do more with apprenticeships, terms and conditions for construction sector professionals, and new building technologies and employment opportunities. But it is simply not the case that we couldn't be delivering more homes, and particularly more social and crucially affordable homes, within the existing labour market. In fact, according to government, there's been an increase in 20,000 construction sector workers in the last number of years. And keep in mind, workers follow the money. So if there are good quality, well-paid jobs in construction, and particularly public sector-led construction, that will generate employment in and of itself. So we can do more with what we have, but as we move over the next 5 to 10 years, absolutely we have to increase the size of that sector. And that is about key areas of investment and crucially making sure that the work that people do pays for them to be able to live good quality lives here at home.
Okay, let me put a question to you that I put to Peter McVerry just before we came to you, and it relates to this statement this morning that population growth seems to be a very significant factor in leading to a situation where demand is greater than supply. Something like 120,000 people came into this country last year and we only built 29,000 houses last year. Is it time to put a halt on immigration until demand is matched by supply and then restart the immigration program then?
So again, it's important that we have a kind of a fact-based discussion on this. So first of all, we're inside the European Union and there's free movement within the European Union, so you can't stop people travelling in and out of the European Union. And if we were to try and do that, it would have an even more negative impact on us because we avail of that free movement within the EU.
Can I stop you there?
I'll come to each section of it, but it's important just we take it step by step. The second thing is a lot of the inward migration last year was people from the war in Ukraine, and they're under temporary protection orders. And there has been an increase in people from outside the European Union applying for international protection. Those people aren't in the mainstream housing system. They're in temporary emergency accommodation. They're in hotels, they're in communal buildings or in shared accommodation. And therefore, as it stands, those people aren't putting any additional pressure on our housing system. The problem with our housing system, first of all, is we have 10 years of pent-up demand where supply didn't meet kind of new household formation within our own population. And as great levels of new household formation and returning Irish come back, that's a real challenge. I'm firmly of the view that, and again, Owen Burke Kennedy in the Irish Times make this point today, we have the money. We have the public land and we have workers to accelerate the delivery of high quality permanent homes, both for the people who are currently living here and the new households that will be formed, as well as in migration from within the European Union because of economic growth and returning Irish migrants. So the straight answer to your question is no, I don't think you need to put a halt to people coming into the country, either those who have rights to permanent housing or those who are being accommodated temporarily. I think what we need is a better government and a better plan, both to tackle the housing and homelessness crisis and also to ensure that those people who are seeking protection from war or persecution have decent quality temporary accommodation in the state while we're providing them with refuge.
Okay, well, just let me just make the point, and I was about to interrupt you there earlier on. Only this weekend, and I was reading this last night before I went to bed, Denmark has decided to put a halt on immigration because of issues over housing, that too many people are coming into the country and they don't have enough houses. Sweden has already put a ban on immigration because not only of housing supply, but other social problems. So the point being is, it can be done if the will is there. But to move on, and
Can I make this point? Of course, it can be done in the sense that anything can be done. But if you go back to what we talked about a moment ago in terms of construction, or if you look around another a series of areas of our economy, we're almost at full employment. We have significant labour shortages in a range of areas, in some in healthcare, in some in construction, some in other areas. And therefore, it's really important for us to be clear. Our problem is not that the state could not provide accommodation either for its resident population or those seeking international protection. Our problem is we have a government that cannot organise anything properly. And it's not just our housing system, it's health, it's childcare, it's other areas. So I'm absolutely of the belief, like, we have almost 100,000 plus vacant homes across the state. Government had a €5 billion surplus last year. There is very, very significant tracts of public land that has currently not been utilised. If government actually had the will and the ambition to tackle the housing and homelessness crisis over a number of years, they could do that, and we could ensure that those people who are fleeing war and persecution, particularly in Ukraine, could get a decent quality of emergency accommodation while they're seeking refuge here.
Okay.
Those things are possible. You're right, they're not being done, but that's a political failure. And therefore, I actually think what we need to do is change the government change the entry rules into the state.
Just one final question, Owen. Basically, this report this morning is effectively saying that if we don't build 60,000 houses per year until 2050, it will prevent the growth of the Irish economy. What are the implications if we can't meet these targets for the Irish economy?
Yeah, and be very clear that the report isn't saying we need 60,000 homes next year. The report is providing a range saying over the next decade we're going to need between 40 and 60,000 a year. And I think what that means is right now, next year and the year after, the level of need is somewhere around 40 to 45,000. You're absolutely right. Employers have been saying for a very significant period of time that the failure of the state to ensure we have an adequate supply of housing, and particularly affordable housing for working people, is creating difficulties. For example, if you go around Dublin or some of our other large cities, school teachers can't afford to live in the communities in which there are jobs available in schools. Employers are telling us that they can't get staff. International investment and the IDEA are telling us would be negatively impacted. So it is a real problem, but this isn't new information. We have known this for many years. And that's why what is needed more than anything else is a complete change of approach by government, greater ambition, greater investment, higher targets and better delivery, particularly of affordable homes at prices that working people can afford.
Okay, Owen, we're going to have to leave it there. That's the Sinn Féin TD for Dublin Midwest and his party spokesperson on housing, Owen O'Brien. More to come. We'll take a break.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
Sarah was in touch regarding our discussion there on the housing shortage. Sarah says that the IBEC survey findings are not remotely surprising. The house prices here are ludicrous and the rent levels are not any better. So why would any new talent be enticed to move to Ireland? People are continually being priced out of the market. Margaret was in touch. She says that she doesn't know where the government expect to find construction workers to build all these necessary houses. We don't have enough builders as it is to meet our targets. So how are we supposed to meet these new targets being laid down by the government? Now, the Council of Europe's expert group on violence against women will visit Ireland, as one woman per week has died in violent circumstances so far this week. The Grevio Committee visiting Ireland will examine Ireland's implementation of the Istanbul Convention on violence against women as it tours the country, meeting survivors of violence, government bodies and NGOs. Nolene Blackwell is a familiar voice on this programme. She's the CEO of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre, and she can tell us that there's been a rise in the number of people attending sexual assault treatment units in this country. First of all, Nolene, how bad is the current situation?
Yeah, Ken, I think either I heard you wrong or you might have said just something slightly inaccurate on the number of women killed. It's one a month, not one a week. So just like while it's still awful, it's just to correct that. So
well,
11
just let me stop you there.
Women
died, let me stop you there, Nolene. I'm quoting Laura Lynott in today's Irish Independent,
And
she's saying that one woman per week has died in violent circumstances so far this year. So I think it's
misunderstanding. Okay, all right, sorry about that. I picked you up wrong then in the way. Anyway, so how bad is the problem and how serious is it? So one of the things that I suppose we are seeing today and this week, when this specialist committee is coming from the Council of Europe to talk to the Irish government and to others as well in this area, is it allows a spotlight to be shone on the question of what was, until very recently, a very hidden problem of domestic violence, sexual violence, intimate violence, violence that happened in silent places and where, to be truthful, our society didn't want to hear about it. So one of the things we are really lacking in this area is a good base figure. So if we knew sort of objectively what the situation was like 5 or 10 years ago, we would be able to say the situation is getting better or worse. But actually the statistics we have are very poor indeed. So one of two things could be happening. In the context of increasing reporting, so more people are reporting to sexual assault treatment units, more people are reporting to the guards, more people are reporting and disclosing to the National 24-Hour Sexual Violence Helpline, which we run, a confidential helpline, every single year. And that we guess, but that's all we can do, is a combination of people who are suffering terrible abuse and it may be getting worse, and also people who before had no one to tell because there was no one interested in it. They didn't feel they'd be believed if they went to the guards. They didn't feel that they would get any remedy if they went and reported it to a sexual assault treatment unit, and often they didn't even know that they could report it to us. So it's probably a combination of an increased recognition by people of all genders, but actually mostly women, that sexual violence and domestic violence are never, ever the fault of the person who experiences it, and that they are not responsible for it in any way, and that they can report it and get help, and if they want to, they can take it to the justice system as well.
Okay, well, are you getting any sense that the number of sexual assaults is up, or is it a case of women now are just more confident about going to report the actual assault on them?
I think it's a bit of both, you see. I think there's a real possibility that right now, post COVID, we noticed an immediate increase in the number of people reporting sexual assaults to us on the helpline. Now, they don't have to report it to the guys after that. This is just on the helpline. That's because people were going out more. And there is a real worry that younger people are more sexually active than they were, and that they are suffering sexual violence, and that they are reporting it more. So there is a danger that, in fact, the range of people being assaulted is increasing. But undoubtedly, there is also that as well, that people are realising they don't have to put up with it without getting help for themselves, without getting assistance. You know, like the sexual assault treatment units, for instance, like they are there to, yes, to collect evidence if Gardaí are investigating a case,
sure,
and evidence is needed, but they're also there to give people, you know, treatment in case against maybe getting some sort of disease or harm out, sure, of a sexual encounter. So there is that sense in which people are recognising it is something that there is help out there for,
right,
and going for it.
Let me ask you this question. In 2022, last year, there was a public awareness campaign, a lot of what are called information broadcasts on television about the new law in relation to coercive control.
Yes.
Is this, if you like, helping or encouraging more women to come forward? In other words, is the new public awareness campaign on coercive control delivering the desired result?
Yeah, so undoubtedly it is. I mean, the thing is, of course, coercive control is only a crime in Ireland since 2019. So the reality was, even if you knew it was happening to you before, going to the Gardaí wasn't going to be much use because they couldn't prosecute it very well. Now they can prosecute it. So the campaign that was there about coercive control, and the campaign that was there that was saying to share someone else's intimate image was a wrong thing to do as well, and a criminal offence. Both of those had the effect of making a lot of people aware of things they genuinely never knew were considered wrong in the eyes of the state before. So they are helping. So too is it helping that the guards are better equipped and they're better at hearing the cases that come into them. You know, there was kind of a feeling before that they would be disregarded, whereas now the guards are being better trained in that area.
Yeah, just one final question. Well, certainly two final questions before I let you go. I've been reading elsewhere that some women show up at refuge centres and there are enough beds.
Yes.
Is this compounding the problem?
Yeah, no, that again, that's just one of the problems that we've had for a very long time and that hasn't been spoken about. Whereas now it's absolutely recognised that for people who are fleeing, sometimes the children, sometimes on their own, the risk of imminent violence, there aren't enough beds available. The Minister for Justice has promised to double the number of refuge spaces, and that will only bring us up to a minimum figure that we should have in this country based on the number of people we have in the country. I mean, ultimately, Ken, we are hoping for a society where the person who has to leave the house, who has to leave the home, is the person who's carrying out the harm. But in the meantime, we'll always have a need for refuges, and those safe spaces, just there aren't enough of them there at the moment.
Okay.
And sometimes they're totally full.
Okay, just finally, Nolene, very briefly, if there's anybody listening to this programme that's in a violent relationship and doesn't know what to do, what advice would you give them?
So I would say first of all, if somebody is in immediate danger of anything or other, just dial 999 and get on to the Gardaí. Then there are confidential, non-judgmental helplines where you can just talk about what the matter is. And so if it's a question of sexual violence, you would call our helpline, and the number there is 1-800-77-88-88. It's there 24 hours a day, every day of the week. There's a text service with it now and a web chat service. It's in other languages if English isn't your first language. But it's a good start, and we can signpost people on to other supports.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. That's sound advice from Nolene Blackwell there, CEO of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. More to come. We'll take a break.
Michael Reed on LMFM.
Don't forget, if you do want to get in touch, you can text or WhatsApp us on 086 1800 658 or give us a call on 041 98 32 000. Eric was in touch regarding housing. He says, the Taoiseach stated in the Dáil that many of our new residents from the Ukraine are likely to remain here. So where are the houses going to come from to offer them a permanent residence when we already have so many on the housing waiting lists? It's impossible to see how we can manage to house everyone. Okay, moving on and back to local matters, and plans for a major extension to Meath County Council's HQ at Bevinda House in Navan to provide a new council chamber and additional office accommodation are currently on public display. Now, the new council chamber is the main feature of the design, and the 3,220 square metres, two- and three-storey extension will also include ancillary councillor office space for 155 additional staff, and a garden courtyard area. The estimated cost of the project is, wait for this, €21 million. One person who has an opinion on this is Emer Tobin, who is a councillor in Meath County Council, and joins me on the line right now. I should point out, Emer, that we've been in touch with Meath County Council, and so far nobody has got back in touch. So I have to ask you these questions as if I sound objective, and indeed that it's all a good idea. I presume you wouldn't object to the fact that the council is building on additional space to house 155 additional staff. What's wrong with that?
Good morning, Ken, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to discuss this issue. Well, look, it's a fine building. Everybody, when they would have heard that Meath County Council was buying the building, said, wow, that's going to be a great space for Meath County Council staff. But the point is, now we have blended working trial starting next week for nearly 380 Meath County Council staff. So basically that means blended working is going to kick in for 6 months to see is it workable. And a large number of the council staff have taken up, they applied for it and have taken up the option to do it. So this is going to free up a huge amount of office space, because these staff members are going to be able to do 2 days from home, 3 days in the office. And the idea is that hot desking will replace the dedicated workspaces for office members or office staff. So really, I can't see the need for extra staff to be built on to the existing building, because as we know, the whole area of blended working has gained huge popularity. There's greater numbers looking to do it, and there's obviously legislation coming down the line where people will have a right to request the option to work remotely. So bearing all this in mind, there is definitely going to be less need for office space everywhere in the country, as well as in our own county.
I should add, by the way, that just as I speak, we got a reply from Meath County Council, and all it simply says, and it was sent to our producer, Maggie Maguire, the council cannot comment on live planning applications. So that's the Meath County Council response on this. But one would ask the question, Emer, that if people in Meath elect councillors to Meath County Council, do you people have any say or no say whatsoever when it comes to the way the council spends money on projects like this?
Well, it is true, Ken. We don't have a say on this matter. This application has gone directly from the council to On Board Pleanála. It is a live application. Now, the date for submissions from the public actually closed last Wednesday, so people cannot have a say on it. But getting back to our ability to influence this decision, we don't have a vote on it because this application is in an area, a special area of conservation. So that's why it's gone straight to On Board Pleanála. But, you know, you mentioned 21 million. The cost is expected to be between 21 million and 26 million. So we don't know where the cost would finally end. It would be up as high as 26 million. But you know yourself, there's an awful lot of problems in this county, 4,000 people on waiting lists. This money would build an awful lot of houses. It would provide a lot of social and affordable houses. It just seems like a bit of a white elephant project.
And would fix a lot of potholes in Meath as well.
There's no doubt. There's no doubt. I experienced a few this morning on the school run, I can tell you, where I live. But seriously, you know, there's an awful lot of people grappling with the cost of living crisis. That's number one. We have, you know, a 12,000 strong population in Johnstown. For years have been looking for community amenities. Nothing has ever been built out there. And there on their doorstep, they see a planning application sign outside the Vinda House, looking to extend their beautiful building to add more council office space and a new chamber. And the thing is, we have a council chamber on Railway Street, and there's no doubt it is a little bit cosy, but the fact that we only use it once a month, it's perfectly workable, in my opinion. And like, when this plan came out and we heard the amount of money that was involved, Ainsley just could not stand by and just say, oh yeah, let's go with this. We have to put our opinion out there. This money could be used on so many other areas that would enhance people's lives. This project is obviously going to make the working lives of Meath County Council staff members much better. And there's no doubt we'd all love bigger and brighter offices. But it just doesn't seem like the wisest way to spend this kind of money, considering we're in a cost of living crisis.
Yeah, but if somebody wants to build a shopping centre or a housing estate or whatever, they have to go through all sorts of hoops to get permission. And it seems Meath County Council is going to go ahead with this. I can't see too many members of the public complaining about offices being built as extensions up at Bovinda House, which is a little bit off that main road there in Johnstown. And it comes back to what I said in my previous question. Doesn't it say something maybe poor about the way the councillors conduct their business at Meath County Council, that you can't keep tabs on the council? It seems the council can do whatever they want, and the very reason you people were elected, you can't, if you like, whip them into order, if you'll pardon the phrase.
Well, look, there's no doubt our area of influence is...
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Is small. You know, we can certainly vote on Part 8 applications, but on an application like this, we can put our ideas forward, we can, you know, express our opposition, but really, we wouldn't have huge impact on their decision. If it's something they feel they want, they can go ahead with it. But as I say, we have a chamber on Railway Street. Although it's cosy, it certainly fits the bill. We only meet once a week. We don't need, you know, this like, I saw plans. I saw plans for the council chamber, Ken. It looks amazing. There's absolutely no doubt it would be fabulous in the sense of, from an architectural point of view, but from a practical point of view, a room that's only going to be used once a month is not needed now. We're in a desperately tough time, and the largesse of this plan does not sit well with so many people. You know, the money could be put to better uses. This is taxpayers' money at the end of the day. We should be working to use this money in a far more productive way. This is not going to make people's lives better, or it's not going to house people. This actually, if we actually work out the 26 million, that would build 74 houses. Now, I know that doesn't sound like a huge amount of houses, but that's an awful lot of people's lives that are improved, and for children. Like, I mean, I just don't even want to start talking about the homelessness, the cost of that problem currently on the children and on the stressed out parents. You know, the human cost of that is phenomenal. And then we hear a local housing authority looking to extend office space, and the amount of money, it grates with an awful lot of people. People are just thinking it's not necessary right now.
Let me ask you this question. Are you the only one making noise about this, or are other councillors up in arms about the fact that 21 to 26 million is going to be spent on extending and modernising the Meath County Council offices at a time when there are lots of boarded up buildings in the county of Meath that could be used for housing? And as I mentioned earlier on, there's no end to the country lanes in Meath that are riddled with potholes.
I'm sure there are many councillors, Ken, that have reservations, and I'm sure there's people who think this does not send out a good, you know, message to the public about prioritisation of where money goes. But I'm not going to speak on anybody else's behalf, you know, but there's an awful lot of people very unhappy with how money is spent in this county from a councillor's point of view, that the prioritisation seems weak in some areas, and there's you know, but you know, it is difficult. It is difficult sometimes for councillors to go against the council. You know, just to be clear on that, we all have to work together. There is a certain element of, you know, of if I back you on this, will you back me on that? So it isn't easy to be seen to oppose the council. And okay. You know, I find it difficult at times sometimes to oppose the council, but I feel an issue as important on this, that the greater good will be served by calling this out. It's not something, you know, that needs okay. to have this level of funding spent on.
Sure. Just one final question, Emer, apart from you coming on LMFM and giving a few quotes to the Meath Chronicle, is this now the end of the matter, or have you plans to make more noise about this?
Well, I would have done a certain amount of work about it on social media. I sent in a submission, obviously, to On Board Planola last week, expressing my opposition and that this money should go elsewhere, to the more needy causes. I also asked the council, you know, if they're really, I won't say hell-bent, but if they really want to push ahead on this, why don't they sell off the chamber on Railway Street and use the money, the revenue generated from that, to cover some of the cost? I didn't get an answer on that, but, you know, hopefully that could be something that might be considered. And I also want to see how much would it cost to make the chamber building on Railway Street IT ready so that meetings could be accessed remotely.
All right.
But maybe that's one of the reasons that they're pushing for the bigger office space and extension. But, you know, the blended learning thing is something I feel strongly about. If there's more people going to be working remotely, we don't need more office space.
Yeah, sure. Okay, well, that seems to make sense. We're going to have to leave it there. That's Councillor Emer Tobin talking to us about a plan by Meath County Council to spend somewhere in the region of 21, 22 million on new office staff at a time when there will actually be less people working in the building. And I should point out that Meath County Council were in touch and they say the council cannot comment on live planning applications. Okay, more to come. We'll take a break.
Michael Reed on LMFM.
Now, it's hard to believe that it's almost 20 years since the ban on smoking in the workplace was introduced. It was March 29th, 2004. Publicans were kicking up hell at the time, saying all their pubs would close down, it would destroy rural Ireland, and the social scene would die a death in this country, and of course it never happened. But Ireland was leading the way on this, and many other countries have followed. But now a drive is underway to secure something like 9,165 signatures in this country, which will be part of a wider petition campaign to achieve 1 million signatures under what's called the European Citizens Initiative. This was something we voted for in the Lisbon Treaty back in 2009, which means that if 1 million signatures can be guaranteed on a particular issue, the European Commission will give it consideration. Well, a move, as I say, is on to make a tobacco-free Europe within the next 5 to 10 years. One man who's leading the drive in this country is Professor Luke Clancy. He's the Director General of the Tobacco Free Research Institute of Ireland, and he joins me on the line right now. Professor Clancy, first of all, what's behind this initiative?
Good morning, Fred. As you suggest, this is an initiative by the people, a citizens' initiative, as it's called, not very often used, but a very important mechanism where the people can tell the executive, as it were, what they would like to happen. And to get this initiative going, you have to apply to the commission, and they've got to go through it and see that it's compatible with what they're doing. And then if it's accepted, you as a citizen and as a group of citizens and organizations had, as you suggested, to collect a number of signatures. Now, the number for Ireland is, as you said, but the need at a European level is 1 million. And that has to be done within 1 year. So it's a very good mechanism as well for getting the message out there. So this message is that we would like to have a tobacco-free Europe, and how to get at that, according to this, is to follow the New Zealand people and say that you won't allow children who are born after 2010 to buy cigarettes, which means they'd never have access to cigarettes, so they would never be addicted nor have to give them up or anything. And this would be a great mechanism. The other big aim of it is to try and clean up the environment. You know, there's 4.5 trillion butts thrown away each year in the world. And this is a huge cause of pollution and acetate getting into the systems and causing damage to citizens. So it's a win-win, as it were. It would stop the people, it would bring this to everybody's notice, and it would help the environment.
Okay, well, you're looking for 1 million signatures across Europe, and the quota for Ireland is 9,165. If you don't get the 1 million signatures, I think, you have 365 days to get the 1 million signatures, that if you don't get them, then your campaign will be seen as a failure. Would it not be logical to sort of bypass the signature or the petition process and lobby the powers that be in the European Commission otherwise?
Well, I think there is competence at European level, but there's also member states involved here. And this is, if you go directly to the Commission, for instance, they'll say, well, is there any support for this? Who says we should do it? But if 1 million European citizens say to the Commission, this is something we want you to take action on, then it's a very strong message, but also it's part, as you suggest, of the relationship with the Commission. They have promised that if 1 million people in Europe want something, they'll do something about it. And it gives it great power, and it gives an opportunity to the people to say, because we often see government initiatives and they say, oh yeah, but it'll do this, as you suggest, there to do terrible damage to X, Y, and Z. But if this comes from the people, then they've got over that part already. And then it becomes part of the duty of the Commission to make sure that something happens about it.
OK, well, you're famous for being involved with ASH, which was Action on Smoking and Health. And I was making the point there in my introduction that we introduced the ban on smoking in the workplace back in 2004. How have we been doing since then? I mean, have smoking rates dropped? Have admissions to hospital for lung cancer dropped? What stats have emerged since 2004?
Well, it has been a huge success. The first thing that happened was that you don't see smoke in pubs or anywhere else of a public order. So that when you walk in, you're not polluted by internal pollution. So we measured the level of pollution in pubs, etc., and it had fallen to near nothing. Even though at the time, as you said, the industry was saying it would ruin the world. But apart from that, it was also saying that much of the air pollution in pubs was due to cooking and wasn't due to cigarettes at all. Yet when this happened, even though there's an increase in food in pubs, the level of pollution fell dramatically. So that was the first success. Then, as you suggest, there's also a reduction in disease. We showed that there was 3,000 fewer admissions per year to hospitals, and we showed that the mortality from heart attacks fell. Now, part of that's not all due to the smoke-free. There's also other things like better treatment for hypertension and better care when they do get to the hospital. And so that's complex, but that fell as well. So we have an improvement in hospital admissions, in mortality. And one of the interesting things we found is most things that you do seem to benefit well-off people because they have better access and they better take better care of it and so on. But this was something we found that socioeconomically was more helpful for poorer people. Now, I suspect that part of that is because the people who work in the service industries were exposed to smoke at their work and had no choice. And this fall that we saw was more, it was across the board, but was more obvious in the poorer people and the lower paid people. So it was a huge thing because very often, as I say, interventions benefit those that are already well off.
Okay, I'm reminded of that movie. I'm sure you saw it more than once. That movie called The Insider, which looked at the whole tobacco delivery business in the USA. And I'm just wondering that if somebody like you and your counterparts elsewhere across the EU are basically going to put the push on the EU Commission to make Europe smoke-free, aren't you up against very strong lobbying from representatives of the tobacco industry who've got, you know, big checkbooks and very qualified and talented lawyers who will lobby the EU Commission about the socio-economic effects of making Europe smoke-free, the job losses, the loss to the economy and so on? Aren't these the type of things you're up against if you go down this road?
Absolutely. But whether you go down this road or not, the tobacco industry's initiative and their raison d'etre is to make profits. So they want more people to be addicted. They want our children in particular to be addicted because they're the replacement. You know, one in two people who smoke die because of it. So if that's going to happen, they need replacements. So they got to get to our children and addict them. So they do everything in their power to stop this. And as you're suggesting, I think it's a fact that the highest number of lobbyists for any organization or any industry is the tobacco industry in Europe. But that's why I think there's great power in the people coming and saying, this is not between politicians or bureaucrats. This is about the people saying, we want this done. And if they do, they must sign on. And as you know, that's the important bit. This is online signing, and they must do it, though. It's not enough that they wish for it to happen. It has to be done.
I'll come to the online signing in just a minute or two. But in terms of the campaign that your colleagues elsewhere across Europe are undertaking, I mean, what are they doing to try and get the message out about the fact that you want 1 million signatures? You know, are they getting on their local radio stations in the Netherlands or Italy and pushing the point, or you know, are they just hoping that the whole of Europe will just log on to some website and they'll come across this by accident and hopefully by chance they'll get 1 million signatures?
Certainly not. You're quite right. They're doing all the things that we're doing, only some of them are well resourced and are doing it better. However, they probably aren't on with you this morning, which is a great bonus to me, and I'm delighted and thank you very much for it. But they have had press conferences where they've brought people together and announced this. We sent out a press release because we don't have any resource to assemble people. But they're doing that. They're going also to the health departments. I was reading this morning, both in Poland and in Italy, the health ministries and the ministries for the environment have pledged their support and are going to back them and get it on all government things. There's been no response from our government yet, but there's time and we're hopeful that they too will get involved. But it needs the people, and that's why this is ground up, and that's why it's fantastic to be on local radio, and I'm grateful for that.
Sure. Just two questions before I let you go, Professor Clancy. Have you concerns about vaping? Youngsters are going into shops and buying these vaping devices, which contain, in a lot of cases, nicotine. It hooks them onto nicotine. And before you know it, youngsters are then smoking cigarettes. I mean, what are your concerns about vaping?
Well, we're very concerned about vaping. It's very prevalent. And what we've been researching this for years now. And what we have found is that increasingly the young people who start vaping have never smoked a cigarette. And as you suggest, they become addicted to nicotine. And we have found and shown that if they do become addicted to nicotine or if they do use vapes, that they're twice as likely to start smoking. Now, in other countries, they found it's even more likely, up to four times. But our figures are that it's more than twice as likely to start smoking. And that's why the vaping industry, even though there's a lot of independence, it's dominated by the tobacco industry, who see this as a way into our children and addict them. They say it's for adults, but in fact, we have found that it's very prevalent, and something like 18% of the young kids of 16 years of age are regularly using e-cigarettes. And we know that they are much more likely to smoke. And also in with regard to pollution, there's a huge pollution element with e-cigarettes. Not only, as Minister Smith has pointed out, the loss of lithium, etc., okay, which we need, but the plastic itself is getting into the system and they're disposable. There's now even single-use stuff, which are single-day, which are gone the next day into the pollution.
All right. Just one final question, Professor Clancy. If somebody wants to sign this petition to do their bit for Ireland and Europe, where exactly should they go?
Well, it's online, it's on the Commission, but it's also on all the websites of the health organisation. For instance, on our website, which is tri.ie, but it's on the Heart Foundation, it's on the Thoracic Society, it will be on the Cancer Society, so it's on all the health organisations. And I'm hoping that people like yourself will also help us get the message out.
Yes,
there.
We will. We definitely will. We'll have it on the LMFM website as well. Okay, we'll leave it at that, and the best of luck with that campaign. It's a very worthy and honourable campaign to rid Europe of tobacco in the next 10 years or so. That's Professor Luke Clancy, Director General of the Tobacco Free Research Institute of Ireland.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
Now, regarding our discussion earlier on housing targets, Liam was in touch to say we haven't a hope in hell of getting on top of our housing targets in this country. The government are living in cloud cuckoo land with the targets they are putting out. Instead of focusing on building all the time, why is more not being done to renovate the thousands of empty houses, apartment blocks that are lying vacant all over the country? Surely that is a more realistic and achievable way of helping to free up accommodation. Mary was in touch. She says it's all well and good for Owen O'Brien and Sinn Féin to talk about all the wonderful things they would do if they were in government, but how many of their proposals are actually attainable? It's all very easy to have all the answers when you are not the one charged with actually solving the problems. We're forever being told that Sinn Féin will wipe the boards at the next elections, so let's just wait and see what they can deliver on their proposals if they make it into government next time. Okay, moving on. You may recall that there was a pretty horrific story last month in Moneygall in Offaly, where something like 50 lambs were killed as a result of an attack from a dog. It cost farmer John Healy €10,000 in financial losses, and the pictures on the Irish Farmers Journal website make pretty depressing viewing. This is a serious problem in rural Ireland. One man who's been keeping an eye on this is Kevin Comiskey. He's the chairman of the IFA National Sheep Committee, and he joins me on the line right now. Kevin, a working group on dog control has been established, and it follows on as well, arising from the attack on the little boy down in County Wexford, a young man called Alejandro Misan, 9 years of age, from Enniscorthy. As we know, he was attacked, and the pictures of the attack he suffered made pretty horrific viewing as well. What's happening in terms of dealing with this problem?
Okay, good morning, Ken, and good morning to your listeners. Yes, it's the working group now, to my knowledge, was set up last weekend, Thursday or Friday. Hopefully it'll come to some decision and get what we want. We and IFA are very clear, and I'm very clear what's needed. And like the last listener said there, what the proposals we have is 100% attainable. It's microchipping. Every dog must be microchipped, bottom line. Every dog must be licensed and linked to the appropriate owner. A single national database put in place, and also the sanctions put in place to reflect the horrendous damage that these dogs do on farms, and indeed, as you mentioned, to the likes of that young, unfortunate poor boy. Horrific, horrific incident there. So it's we're very clear. The working group has seemingly set up. I don't think this should take long getting around this and getting the, what's needed into place. Most importantly, then, is enforcement and resources put in place for the enforcement. And when all that's put together, it should not take long. The working group, fair enough, to put it together, but it should take very little time. One meeting, two at the most, it should be sufficient.
Well, all that sounds very good and honourable, but how do you deal, for example, with the problem of stray dogs?
Well, just about an hour ago, I had a phone call from a man, a farmer, got a stray dog on his land this morning. He got the dog, he got him into his trailer, and he brought him to the vet and couldn't know who the owner was because the dog wasn't microchipped. So the dogs have to be microchipped to link them into the license and the appropriate owner.
Well, you know, and I know, not everybody has a dog license. People buy dogs as pets. They don't think about getting a license. Nobody knocks on the door and says, excuse me, but do you have a license for your dog? Isn't that part of the problem?
Of course. That is part of the big problem. Enforcement. Enforcement is a big issue. And that's where it is. People out, even walking their dogs. Dog wardens has to be out there on the ground, checking for dog licenses, checking for microchipping. And it'll all fall into play. When people hears that the dog warden is out, they'll say, oh, I must get a license. Do you know what I mean? And it's the same with our animals. We have to have our animals all electronically tagged now. When we go to the vet to get a prescription for to get an injection for a sheep or a lamb or a calf, we have to give the tag number of that animal. And the exact same rule should be in play for when you go with your dog to get him treated, to get him vaccinated or her vaccinated, whatever. When you go to the vet, before the vet can administer anything or carry out any exercise on that dog must be microchipped and must be licensed. And that would be a good way of enforcing it as well.
OK, I mean, there seems to have been a pattern or a trend. I think I saw a story there, I think towards the end of last year, about a child being killed by a dog in England. And there seems to be certain dogs that are more likely to attack children. Has the time come to ban certain species of dogs in this country?
Certainly, that's something would have to be looked at. And what they call the dangerous breeds, all these dangerous breeds, has to be on muzzles. There is legislation there that has to be on muzzles, that has to be on a lead at all times. And what I'd say, all them breeds should be notifiable to the Gardaí as soon as you get one. If you are allowed to get one, it should be notified that the guards know exactly where these, and the dog wardens knows exactly where these dangerous breeds are. But certainly those animals that's attacking children and that's a non-runner. They should, I think they should be banned. Yeah, it'd have to be looked at.
OK, well, this working group on dog control met on the 26th of January. When you meet again, how hopeful are you that the measures that are required to deal with this issue will be put in place?
Well, as I say, a couple of meetings at the outset should be enough. Now, unfortunately, I'm not on that. I thought I might be asked because I had a lot of input and a lot of work done on this. I haven't been asked or invited to the meeting. I'm not sure who's involved in it or who's on the committee. But it's not rocket science in my mind to do what's needed for this. It's sit around the table. I know there's three departments involved. Now there's a working group set up. That's another entity. I don't want all these things to be spread out. It should be pulled in under one department, I think, and the Minister for Agriculture should take control of this, have it all under one umbrella and work from there. And the dog out in the local authorities, where the enforcement has to happen. There's only 60 dog wardens in the country. It's totally unacceptable. There should be, in my just own view, I think there should be at least 300. Now, I'm not sure on exactly how many should be there, but I'd say in that region anyway. I see 10 below in Cork County alone, and that could be a good example where they could replicate their ideas on that. But all the county managers and all the local authority managers should be brought into a room and say, OK, this is what we want done. this is the way it should be done, and get them out there and put resources in place to do it.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. That's Kevin Comiskey. Thanks very much for joining us, Kevin. Kevin is chair of the IFA National Sheep Committee. Now we're going to North Louth for our next story, and Councillor Antoine Waters put a posting up on his Facebook page recently with some pretty bad photographs of 18 black sacks of waste, some of them being scattered all over the place. It made very unsightly viewing, and it's reflective of the fact that some people just won't pay to get rid of their waste. They believe that certain public lands should be used as dumping sites. Antoine joins me on the line right now. First of all, Antoine, I think this happened on the Turf Road in Omead. How bad was the dumping?
Good morning, Ken, and thanks for having me on. Yeah, look, unfortunately, more bad news and more dumping, another negative. But look, it's one of our famous beauty spots in the North Louth area, up over the Turf Mountain, round Eden Tubber, up by the Mast. You know, it's a lovely part of the country, and unfortunately, over the last number of years, I've been on a lot, giving out about people who are taking it for granted and dumping their waste up there, like over the one. It happened last Thursday night into Friday morning. It was quite a bad dumping and all black household waste. And now, lucky enough, good work by the litter wardens, where they have got a name and the fine is to issue. But I think we really need to look at the whole cost of it as well. Like €150 fine when it's paid, it's going to cost a lot more than €150 to clean up this waste. And that's the problem I see. We need to look at how to properly deal with the cost of it, Ken. You know, that's the problem.
Well, are you saying then that the fine should be, we'll say, €1,000, and that might scare or discourage people from, if you like, dumping their waste on open land?
Yeah, we really have to look at it now. I know there is new code of practice coming in for monitoring and CCTV rollout and all in the early part of this year, and I will be looking for an update at the next council meeting to see if Louth County Council can look to implement that. But the fines and the amount that people are paying, I feel, is still low. Like, if you take into account how much it would cost to remove that, I think we need to look at how much is it per kg of waste that's dumped. Or we need to look at it, a better way of dealing with it, because it's not covering the cost to remove it at all.
So what you're saying is the more you dump, the more you should be fined, rather than one flat fee.
I agree, yeah, definitely. That's what my recommendation. And look, yes, you're going to have to look at how this will work and the practicalities of it. But at the minute, I feel the fines are too low, and people, like, the dumping's happening countrywide every day of the week, and it's not good enough. And at the end of the day, it's eating up our resources. The resources are stretched enough as it is, and it could be put to a better use than up lifting that rubbish on the mountain and on one of our mountain sides, you know.
Yeah, isn't one of the problems that's emerged from the privatisation of dealing with waste and rubbish is that private operators simply charge too much, and people think they can get away with this if they dump their waste on open land at no fee. And that if we say, for example, if Louth County Council provided a dump where the fees to dump rubbish was significantly less than what a private operator is charging, they might get better results in the long run. Do you think that would work?
Well, thinking of that, like, we have great services in the recycling centres where you can get rid of a black bag of rubbish for maybe €5 or €6. I know often after Christmas I will be out with all the cardboard recycling and all, and it's very easy to get rid of a black bag of rubbish in there as well. So I think it's people, it's also probably the man with a van, I think, could be a play here as well, where there is people collecting it, as you say, for a small fee. These obviously aren't registered people who can do it, service providers, but that's the problem as well, that they are going around and collecting this waste and it's not been dealt with properly. It's just been thrown up on the side of the mountain in our public land, as we said already. So I feel we really do need to give it a shake-up, because it isn't a problem that's going away. Every so often it's raising its head again. One can be a lot worse than the other. Obviously, all the time there would be one or two bags, but not in as big as what happened over the last couple of days. So I really think a review of the whole process is needed, and that's where we need to go with it.
Without mentioning any names, according to your Facebook post, the name and address of the person allegedly responsible is being dealt with. So what advice would you have for members of the public who spot people dumping rubbish on land where it shouldn't be dumped in order to, if you like, deal with this ongoing problem?
Well, look, that's how, the only way we're going to try and deal with this is the public buy into this and raising awareness of it. But if you see someone dumping it, it's a call straight. I would call the Gardaí and I would also call the council, because that's how you catch these people in the act. It's brazen. These don't care about our area. We love the area we live in, but some people don't care about it as much as we do. And I would be calling for anyone who sees anything that straight away, the first call to the Gardaí and then followed by the council to get the litter wardens out to see if there's any evidence or catch the person in the act. We all see the social media videos of people who are caught in the act dumping. Some of them are very brazen, but it's something that we all need to take a wee bit of responsibility for and try and stamp it out, you know.
OK, we'll have to leave it there. That's Councillor Antoine Waters of Sinn Féin, who was talking there about the dumping of waste on the Turf Road in Omead. We'll take a break.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
Now, the Irish Nature, I hope I've pronounced that word correctly, and Hill Farmers Association have today published its forestry policy. The policy is they maintain a blueprint on how Ireland can overcome the current impasse in afforestation while achieving the three aims of increased carbon sequestration, greater biodiversity and improved water quality. One thing is certain, Ireland apparently needs more forests because they make a huge contribution to the environment. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line right now by Patsy Daly, who is a council rep for Leitrim and West Cavan. You talk about the current impasse in afforestation. Could you just explain to listeners, particularly urban listeners in the Louthmead area who perhaps are not well up on forestation, what the current impasse is?
Okay, can I just maybe start by a small correction? It's Natura, Irish Natura. And
my apologies, my apologies.
No,
you can shoot me at dawn for that one.
It's not that bad. And we focus on sheep farmers. We're relatively new, but we focus on sheep and sucklers. And maybe to take you back, rather than talking about the impasse, let's talk about what the problems are, and then we'll talk about what our solutions are to those problems. You have this situation with Culture and the investment company Gresham House. That's not the real problem. That's a symptom of what I would say is the disease, which is Irish afforestation policy. Irish forestry policy is focused on investors. Irish taxpayers' money is given to these investors, mainly foreign, to buy up land, to outbid young farmers and other farmers who are trying to increase the size of their holdings, and then plant it with Sitka spruce. And it's done because they buy the land, it's done on a whole farm basis. So every farm that's planted is a family less. It's a family gone from the rural community, with all the resulting consequences in terms of the schools, the shops, the pubs, the churches, sports clubs, etc. And for people in rural Ireland, none of us benefit from this model of afforestation. Farmers don't benefit, as I've just said, they're outbid for land. Rural communities don't benefit because, as I said, it results in depopulation. And this is the really baffling part of it all. The environment doesn't benefit. Instead, what you get is you get water pollution from Sitka spruce. You get biodiversity killed by Sitka spruce. And you get little or no carbon sequestration in the long run. And we have to ask, you know, where is the Green Party in all this? Where is Minister Pippa Hackett, who is in charge of land use and forestry? What she's doing currently is she's encouraging and funding the planting of Sitka spruce on peatland and carbon-rich soils, and like I said, causing pollution rather than sorting it out. And what we want to do is we want to take a completely different approach to forestry. We want to get rid of the investors, get rid of Sitka spruce, instead focus on encouraging and funding farmers to plant a portion of their lands and thereby remain in the local community and plant them with native woodlands. Native woodlands improve water quality, they improve air quality, they increase biodiversity, and they have good, in the long term, they have far better carbon sequestration.
Well, that all sounds like common sense, but have you spoken to Pippa Hackett and the people in the Green Party who would like to convince one or two people that they know more than you?
Well, we have an upcoming meeting in Dublin with the public representatives, and we hope that the Green Party will come along to that and Pippa Hackett. And we have sought a meeting with the Minister McConnell and Minister Hackett, but we've given them a copy of our policy, so you know, they know what we're talking about. And you mentioned there that it's common sense, and when you see that a common sense approach isn't being taken, you have to start to worry. And for us in INHSA, the only conclusion that we can come to, and the only conclusion that I can come to, is this is a farmer call. Plain and simple. And this is ongoing forestry policy. It's not something that has been dreamt up in the last couple of weeks or whatever. The culture issue is just a manifestation of the problem of providing funding to investors. And the result of that, as I said, this government of Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Green Party are depopulating large parts of Ireland and replacing it with Sitka spruce. It doesn't make sense.
And what's the, if you like, what's the practice in other countries in Europe? I mean, is Sitka spruce being planted in accordance with the way the Greens think, or are the policies that you're advocating being applied elsewhere?
If you take, for example, Norway, which has a far more enlightened approach to afforestation and much higher levels, obviously, of afforestation, they have banned Sitka spruce. They've recognised it for what it is. It's an alien species. It's not native to Ireland. It's not native to Europe. It comes from Western Canada. It grows very well here. But that is a worrying thing in any of these things. All weeds grow well. Rhododendron on the mountains in Kerry grows very well. Japanese knotweed grows very well. So the fact that it grows very well is not a positive when you look at it from an environmental perspective.
One would have thought that the Greens would be aware of all this. I'm a little bit baffled as to why they don't see it your way. Do you think something else is going on?
I do. Like I said, this is about the Greens in particular, it appears to me, would like to see rural areas depopulated. You don't have the problem of rural cars then and so forth. They want to see large parts of Ireland, the western seaboard and more, all mountainous areas are marginal land areas planted.
Okay, well, hopefully the Green Party might get back to us and give their explanation as to why they're in favour of Sitka spruce trees, as you say. But unfortunately, we'll have to leave it there. And I should stress, you're with the Irish Natura and Hill Farmers Association. That's Patsy Daly there on the line from Leitrim, I do believe. And that just about wraps it up for today. Michael Reid will be back with you tomorrow. I want to thank Chris Murray, who was on sound. Maggie Maguire produced. Sinead Brazel is next. I'm Ken Murray, and I'll talk to you again sometime soon. Until the next time, bye for now.
The Michael Reid Show podcast. Tune in weekdays from 9 on LMFM. To contact us, email now, michael@lmfm.ie.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices?
And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.